relationship with someone, you've got a monogamous relationship, you cheat on partners. And that has one particular type of result, you can see it. But also, there's this, when you look at the environmental result of this, you can see that the sexual misconduct is much more related to the way of the over-exaggerated attachment. You'll see in the results, you know. So the experience similar to the cause, which is sort of related to the one of cheating, is that no relationships last. This is from past life, you know. In this life, your relationship gets shut short, you know, people cheat on you, relationships don't last. It could be any kind of relationship, your parents, your children, your friends, lovers' relationship, you know. That could be the result of past misconduct, past cheating on partners. The other one, though, the environmental result, is more related, it seems to me, to do with the energy of sexual attachment, over-exaggerated. We know it's an immense suffering. You're talking to people who've got serious addiction to sex. It's an extremely mental problem. Look at the pedophiles, you know. They just live in their fantasies. And you can even see by their bodies, you know. People are really serious sexual attachment problems, especially if they're abusive, like the pedophiles and things. You can, by looking at their faces, you can see it's kind of all like yucky and slimy. I'm not being mean about people. You can really see it, can't you? You can tell on people's faces the behavior, because their mind lives in this fantasy world. These elaborate, exaggerated fantasies of sex with children or with types of, you know, exaggerated sexual behavior. It completely changes your body. So that the result is you live in a place where there's urine and feces all around, where it's muddy and dirty and filthy and everything stinks and everywhere seems unpleasant and distasteful. It's kind of interesting. Think about it. You understand? Lots of places on earth are like that. There can be individual houses like this. There can be entire countries like that, you know. You can see. Verbal actions. The experience similar to the cause of lying is really obvious. No one believes you, even if you're telling the truth. Now that, again, can also be in this life. You can see it. You're always lying. No one's going to believe you. But it can even be when you are telling the truth and then people don't believe you. That's definitely from past karma. There's no logical reason why people shouldn't believe you now. You understand what I'm saying? That's when you can see it's past karma. Like if you never steal in this life, but people always steal from you, you know it can't be now. It has to be past karma. So this is so common. This is so typical. Some people, you know, people don't believe what you're saying. Even if you're telling the truth, that's from past karma of lying. Or people are always deceiving you. You know? So common. Look at our lives. This just sort of maps out our lives, you know. The environmental result. Your work in cooperation with others always fails to prosper, and people don't work well together. Look at work and situations like Dharma centers. This is from deceiving others, from cheating, from lying to others, because this is the result of not being straight with your words. Then, you know, people don't believe you, or they deceive you, or things don't work together. People, you know, just really awful. You can see it all the time in life. And this is why I think, again, if we, let's say, assume for the moment that Buddha is right about karma, let's just say that, and if it's true, then when you try to understand situations from the point of view of beginning in this life, 90% of things that happen you can't explain. That's why we have such tortured suffering. Why our major suffering is, why is this happening? I haven't done anything to deserve it. It's true in this life. It's true. It's a fact. This is the source of so much of our pain in this life. Why people are mean and cheat and lie. You know, your husband you've adored all your life and you've been loving and devoted to, who goes and cheats on you and leaves you. There's nothing you've done to deserve it. You're absolutely right. But it's past karma. You can't answer many things without the view of karma. That's why I find it, at least it's an answer. Most people just say, nobody knows. I mean, what a terrible... It's like saying, how do plants grow? Oh, well, nobody knows. We're going to have all these superstitions about why plants grow. It'll be chaos. But at least Buddha has an answer. I find it extremely helpful. The environmental result of lying. Oh, yeah, I just said it. And there's a lot of fear. It seems to me all the speech ones bring up a lot of fear. You're going to see it. Everyone's about fear. You know, people cheat each other. You read about these... I mean, some businesses... I like to read different times, like books about Wall Street, can be companies, you know. And it's just like a nightmare reading it. The minds of people, the things they do, the lying, the stealing, the cheating, the evil. You can see it. Unbelievable. It's like a sewer, you know. Divisive talk. This is one of our heaviest ones. And it's called divisive talk. It's talking about people behind their backs, creating divisions, creating groups. Look at families. Almost everybody I meet has got divisions in their families. Because that's what families do. And then you take sides, especially if the family's big. Some families get entire, they completely cut down the middle. one group against the other group. It's often over money, and it's always talking about each other. If you just never talked about each other, you would not have problems. This is the commonest thing in groups, at work, at family, close where you're working every day with people. It's because if you've got a person, like she's saying, you know, 8 hours a day, these punches, and of course you want to you load off to somebody, you go home and you talk about it. But this is what exacerbates the whole problem. We can't hold it in ourselves. And we see it as out there. So we just go blah, 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 you know. We can't wait to talk about each other behind backs. It's appalling kind of behavior. It causes so much suffering. And this, of course, is the result. In this life, if you have divisions and things, even though you've done nothing wrong, it's again, it's the past karma riding you. Easily you lose friends. People around you are always fighting one another. People around you have an undesirable character. Meaning you live in that type of, you know, with people like that. Prisons, every one of these, I tell you, this is like a blueprint for a prison. Environmental result. Again, it's related to the things that grow. The ground where you live is always covered with obstacles like fallen tree trunks and thorns and stones and broken things and rough and dreary, and there are no streams or lakes or water springs, and earth is the parched and poisoned and burning and useless and hot and threatening, and there's a lot of things to fear. Speech seems to bring this. Idle talk, rabbiting on about nothing. No one listens to you. This is amazing. And that, again, you can see it in this life. This is, again, the point. Remember, if in this life you rabbit on about nothing, you just never stop talking. We all know people like this who groan when they start talking. Of course, no one's going to listen to you. But think of this. Even if you don't talk too much this life and people still don't listen to you, that's because of past idle talk. I think this is girl karma. I mean, girl karma, to be born a girl. Maybe from a boy in past life when you talk too much, but in this life you get born a girl because girls, I mean, it's changing in the West a lot, but for classic situation like born in a country like, say, where you have to wear clothes to cover your body, that's literally where you don't get listened to. I mean, you speak and people, I mean, excuse me, you're not even talking, you're like a sound coming out of the woodwork, you know? Literally you're born in that life. So if you look at the karma of being a woman, no one trusts you. That extreme example. No one trusts what you say. No one believes what you say. No one listens to you. You have no value. You can see it looking at the entire world. You can look at every group of people, individuals. And remember, don't get too personal about this because we've been men countless times and women countless times, you know? So we're all in the same boat together creating ourselves. But it's so interesting. No one listens to you. No one respects what you say. No one thinks your speech has value. So again, there's a difference. In this life, if you rabbit on, male or female, it will be that result. But if you don't rabbit on and then people don't trust you, that shows it's the past karma. You get my point? If you didn't do anything to deserve being abused by your husband in this life, then that's past karma. But if you abuse him every day, you can see that kind of was the catalyst for him to abuse you back, even though still it's past karma, but you catalyzed it by your behavior. There's a difference, you see. You understand my point? Okay, idle talk. Fruits don't grow, you know, or grow at the wrong time, or seem ripe when they're not, or have frail roots, and there's no leisure places like parks or glades or pools, and again, many things to make you afraid. Harsh speech. This is so simple. You'll always be hearing distressing words. This is prisons personified, I tell you. That's it. You live in environments where all you hear around you, people, always distressing, always violent words, unhappy words, abusive words. That's a lot of people's lives, I tell you. And environmental result is so interesting. Listen to this. Harsh speech is like very abusive, isn't it? The environmental result? You live in a desert. Literally nothing grows. So interesting, isn't it? Now we've got mental actions. And like I said, the main level of practice at this stage is about your behavior. And in fact, when you take vows, as you know, if you've taken the five lay vows, they're all about behavior. Lying, killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, alcohol. Their behavior. It's not a discussion of the mind yet. That comes really when you get more advanced. But here is the beginnings. This is like how I like to say it. It's just the beginnings of working on your mind and at the very gross level of working on your mind. And so the way, the three mental actions that Buddha's exhorting us to try and refrain from are the really gross levels of attachment, anger, and ignorance, the three root delusions. So the really gross level of attachment, obviously, is craving, strong craving, greedily wanting things, greedily coveting other people's things, like a serious level of attachment. Do you understand what I'm saying? refraining from this. So the experience similar to the cause of that, meaning from past lives you've got that, your experience will be that your personality will be dominated by desire, by attachment, by dissatisfaction. So you can see some people, like junkies, the 600-pound people. I mean, you don't have to eat a lot to be dissatisfied and always want to eat. You might control yourself. But that terrible, deep feeling of never having enough, always dissatisfied, which is exactly the basis of being a junkie or an alcoholic or eating too much or too much sex, because you greedily, frantically, desperately crave and covet all the time more because you never feel you have enough. So the feeling of never having enough, that's from the past coveting. And then, of course, what you do is you try to get more, but you never get satisfied. No matter what you get, you won't get satisfied. We've all got that disease. That's attachment. But at the extreme level, when in this life you feel incredibly distressed. Like, I can think of a person I know who has got a lovely life. Nice people. She's got good quality. She's talented. But she's got this terrible, we all know this, this terrible dissatisfaction, a sense of darkness and despair, and like she's got nothing and is nothing. Really serious. That's the kind of thing. Deep dissatisfaction, no matter what you have. We've all got it, but the extreme one of it, you know? And the environmental result is everything gets worse very easily, kind of wears out. I always think of India this way, or some parts of India, you know, not the rich ones who live in 35-story houses with multi-billion dollars, the richest people on earth live in India, you know, but the poor ones, the general feeling of poor India. You know, I used to do these pilgrimages every year for about 6 years, raise money for our prison project. We'd go to all the holy places of Lord Buddha, and we'd drive in our bus, you know, for 8 hours, and you just go through these endless villages, and what you see is everything's faded and broken, and all the houses aren't finished built, and nothing ever looks clean. Everything's filthy and dirty and dusty and rotten. That's the environmental result of enormous craving. You get born in that environment from past life craving. Do you understand what I'm saying? So clearly, we look at our environment. That's why we should rejoice so much. We look at our environment, you know, in general in this country. Everything's so shiny. And I come back to this country, we are so blessed, you know. I can't believe when I come back to this country. In every way. The politics isn't that bad. We haven't had a civil war yet, you know. I mean, look at Americans. They're incredible. It's so intense. Their racism is so extreme. Okay, ours is too. But in general, this country, the environment is incredible. Things work reasonably well, you know. Reasonably harmonious, reasonably rich, reasonably... I mean, you know, we've not had any much suffering from the whole dollar thing all these years. In other countries, it's been shocking. Australia's got so much virtue, and that means the individual people labelled Australians have created the cause to be born in this particular situation at this particular time to have those particular experiences. So it's our collective karma. So you rejoice in this. You see, we know we like to feel fortunate, but feeling fortunate is a bit like saying good luck, which good luck means there's no cause. Or aren't I lucky, we say. It means there's no cause. It means it just sort of happened. Or aren't I fortunate, as if someone gave it to me. And people even talk about the universe giving me things. Buddha says, no one gives it to you, dear. You created it. It's a really powerful thing to think, because it makes you own it. And then you think, well, what caused this? Because I like it more. Being good, being moral, don't kill, don't lie, don't steal. That's the learning from it, you know. Okay, when you get to the compassion wing, there we talk about gratitude and giving and thanking and all that. But here we're talking karma and owning our own stuff. It's different approaches for different levels of practice, you know. So the really heavy duty level of anger, you can call it ill will, other terms for it, vindictive, where you think about the person who harmed you and you want to get back and you want them to suffer and you manipulate to make them suffer. Look at so many people have this. This is tortured anger. You can have anger, but if it can go quickly, you're very blessed. But to hold on to it and think about it and want the person to suffer. And many people actually do that, make people suffer. They go and torture them and harm them, you know. And you think about it for years. This is the most intense suffering. You can imagine it. Imagine it. You can't let go of it. This is incredible. That's the heaviest level of anger. So the karma from having that in the past life is in this life. The experience similar to the cause, your mind will be dominated by anger. You'll always find yourself without help. You'll never find the help that you need. You're always hurting others and you're always being hurt by others. Some people, their lives are spent like that. Some people are in abusive relationships from the day they're born. That's this kind of karma. You can be the sweetest person now because you've got the tendency to be loving and kind, but you're born with this karma from past life to be born into environments and situations where you're abused and insulted and attacked, Many of the people in prison have this, and they've come from those situations. They haven't known a single word of kindness all their lives. That's the result of past anger. Do you understand? Past heavy duty anger, ill will. I remember one prisoner, you know, he was in a medium prison as an American. He had to be sent out to the dentist. And he just went to the dentist, and the nurse said to him, "Hello, how are you?" And he burst into tears. Just because the fact that she asked him how he was. Because in the prison, you never hear a kind word. You know? It's just violent all the time, much of the places. The environmental result of ill will is that you live in a world of chaos, diseases spread, evil is everywhere, there's plague, conflict, you have fear of your country's and others' external military, dangerous animals, you are surrounded by harmful spirits, thieves or muggers, and the like. Look at the world. War zones. Exactly this. Israel, you know, maybe not all of Israel, I go there quite a bit, but in Palestine, for example, when you go to the West Bank, or you go to the Gaza Strip, many war zones. Look at Iraq, all the countries, all the Arab countries right now. It's exactly this. Exactly this. That's people's entire lives. So it is the miracle of our blessed lives. You know, our minds can be peaceful. People treat us nicely. You can trust your neighbours. You know, not run. I mean, many parts of America are this way. Of course, this country too. Bits and pieces. You get pockets of it, you know. But the gangs in America are beyond belief. Beyond belief. They are like war zones. Scary as hell. Wrong views is this fundamentalism. I think fundamentalism is a great way to say it. Fundamentalism. I'm right and you're wrong. And it can be about anything. We're all like this with our fights with our husbands. It's not just because you're religious or political. Fundamentalism has been stuck in your position and to the point where it's really extreme, though, where you've got really narrow mind. So an example of being of the experience similar to the cause, your personality is dominated by stupidity. You're as thick as a post, basically. Really limited in your mind, you know, with a lot of superstitious thoughts, very paranoid. You know, you become a person who keeps harmful views like eye for an eye. You're really racist, you're really sexist, you're really kind of abusive. That kind of mind, small-minded, very rigid-minded person. Environmental result, you live in a world where the single highest source of happiness is steadily disappearing from the earth. I never understand what Rinpoche means by that. That's from Rinpoche. I try to work it out and I can't get it. People think, no, okay, maybe it means, yeah, I sort of see. The second part is helpful, where people think that unclean and suffering are actually nice. So, you know, you look at, you know, all these programs, all, you know, I mean, it's sort of like the opposite, ignorance, you know. You know all these programs about all these people who keep all their houses full of shit.
Oh,
hoarders.
Yes.
You see some of the stories. When you know it's not nice, but you can't change it. So you're stuck living in these sewers, you know. When you think of the almost, because you're so attached to those things, and you see some of the people, even to throw away one of their pairs of shoes almost gives them a mental breakdown. They can't do it because you think it's good. So that's where it's obvious to anybody with a reasonable mind, it's really uncomfortable, you know? It's really unhappy. But that you can't see it because you were so, that would be attachment. That was massive attachment. But also ignorance. Ignorance, you know? Huge ignorance.
Doesn't that mean that first part of the sentence means that you have, you know, something that is. Gives you happiness or some sense of gratitude, and that's slowly disappearing as well. Isn't it two things?
I know, it is, but I can't quite get. You live in a world where the single highest source of happiness is steadily disappearing.
Yeah, your one thing that gives you happiness is steadily disappearing.
I know, but I just don't quite get what he means. I hear it. I'm trying to hear it, but then the environmental result of really narrow-mindedness. Anyway, maybe I should look up his commentaries and see what else he says, or see what other lamas say for it. No, I hear you. It's okay. Sentient beings. So that's that, okay? But I want to go back to the delusions now, unless you have any questions about this. Any questions about this? Okay, so just remember again. Okay, yeah, go, darling.
I just had a question.
Yeah.
Within, like, let's look at stealing, for instance.
Yeah.
It can be both in different aspects of your life. You can go from one to the other.
What do you mean?
I can't remember, but I was just thinking during my life.
Yes.
I went from one extreme to it.
Oh, yes, you don't have to have the situation all the time.
Yeah.
It can be different times it can happen to you, you know?
Yes.
You're harmonious and wonderful one time and suddenly a whole bunch of rubbish comes and the hubby leaves you, the kids hate you. Yeah, karma ripens at different times. It can be sometimes a total lifestyle. Like you can see people who live in war zones, live in crummy countries, have no freedom, have no... You know, it can be a total life or it can be moments of it for us. Absolutely, of course it can, yeah.
And it can happen at the same time as well, both aspects.
What do you mean? Well, yeah, of course, some people might trust you, in other words, it mightn't. So it can be a total situation sometimes, or it can be individual. One person never trusts what you say. Maybe you've lied to that person in the past, but another person trusts you. It can always be this. That, for sure, it can be, yeah. That's right, exactly.
Thanks.
Yeah. Shall I go back to the delusions a bit more, I think? Talk about the way these negative states of mind function. And the key one I'm talking about is this way they're delusional, they lie, you know? So let's look at the cake one, for example. We can see how it is a good cake, it's a good cake, it's a delicious cake, you like cake, you know? None of that's a problem. It's when the attachment kicks in, which is the one that runs the show, then that becomes the boss of the whole experience. It makes it look more delicious than it really is. It causes us to believe that when I get it, I'll get happy. Attachment exaggerates it in thinking it'll make me happy. That's the biggest lie of all. It doesn't make you happy. It brings, okay, what does that mean? It does bring some temporary good experience. You can't argue with this. All of our sensory experiences of getting pleasant things is definitely pleasant. The pleasing sunshine, the weather being nice, the food being nice, the sounds nice. We have this all the time. But when it's mixed, the point is, that is pleasure. You can't say it's not pleasure. But when you're attached to it, which means you're thinking about it all the time and you crave it, the more you do this, the more it actually prevents you from actually getting any pleasure. You know yourself, if you're really hungry, when you shove that toast and Vegemite down your throat, you don't even remember eating it. You don't even have, you didn't have the pleasure, there was no time, you just shoved it in like a pig, you know? And that's what happens when you're drunk or when you're on, I didn't like alcohol much, so I used to smoke dope, you know? Then you'd really be ravenously hungry. But somehow when you smoke dope, you tend to sort of try and nourish, you would enjoy it actually. You try to kind of get pleasure from it. But when you're alcohol, I think when you drink alcohol, you become very dead somehow. And you just have no memory of any pleasure. You have sex with a person for 5 hours, you wouldn't remember it, people say. You have no memory because you're so dull. Attachment dulls your mind, they say. You become like an animal. And I'm not being rude about animals. I'm trying to give an analogy, that's all. The more attachment, the more... And you can see it. You can see it. You can see it. If you're addicted to something, you think about it all the time. Just food. You think about it. You get it. You manipulate. You're waiting. You're anticipating it. You get it in the mouth. You shove it in so quickly. You shove it down your throat. And then you sit back. Oh. The whole scenario, you know. It was deadened. Whereas if you know yourself, if you eat kind of more with a clear mind, you enjoy it more. There is more pleasure, actually. There is more in other words, there's more awareness. The more attachment, the less awareness, the less consciousness. That's all. We can see it, you know. So pleasure in itself, like enjoying the sun when you walk outside and the sun on your body when you've been chilly, that, strictly speaking, this is a really subtler way of seeing how it isn't in its nature happy, but how we always grasp it. So what happens? You're in your house, you've got the air conditioning on because it's so hot outside, and you're so relieved to have the air conditioning. It's so delicious, isn't it? But after a while, what happens? It gets too cold, isn't it? So you've got to go outside in the sun again, or you turn it off. Oh, it's so delicious, the warmth. And you, even though it's not gross attachment, it's definitely grasping. We grasp at that warmth. Oh, what a relief, so nice. But what happens? You have to go inside again because it gets too hot. This is the most obvious level of attachment, constantly going up and down like a yo-yo. It doesn't stay. And this doesn't sound very convincing to us, but it's very good logic. The Buddha's saying, if warmth, let's say the warm sun on your body, in its nature, is the cause of your happiness, which it does appear to us after we've come out of the cold. He said, if it is in its nature the cause of your happiness, then the more sun you get, the happier you'll get. Do you understand what I'm saying? Right there, the more you sit in that sun, you'll keep getting happier and happier and happier. But we know that's not true. What happens if you keep sitting in the sun? It gets too hot and you get unhappier and unhappier and unhappier, don't you? That's why it's called the suffering of change. It's actually what we call happiness. And the thing is, we get very depressed by this because we think, well, what the hell are we supposed to do? This is the only happiness we know. And it is the only happiness we know. You understand what I'm saying? Because we have attachment. And see, the reference point for the Buddha for saying this is, he says this is contaminated happiness, polluted happiness, because we don't know any other, and this is his point. What he is saying in the Third Noble Truth is that there is this state of being that you achieve when you removed attachment and the other delusions completely from your mind. What is left is happiness, and it will never, ever, ever change. Can you hear my point? It is impermanent in a subtle sense that it's changing dynamically from moment to moment, but it doesn't go the up and down way we change now. Are you hearing my point? That happiness, Buddha would say, literally is what we're capable of achieving, but we have no reference point for that. We have no experience of that. We don't even believe it exists because nobody has the experience. Can you see what I'm saying? The only way the Christians talk about that, and that's okay, is say that's called heaven. You get that when you're with God. But Buddha says it's a state of mind that you can achieve when you have removed attachment from the mind. Are you with me? That's his point. So that it's in that context we can then judge the happiness we do have now, which is better than nothing. We all got to agree. Better than a punch in the nose, you know. But it doesn't last, and that is a fact everybody can prove. If cake were the actual cause of happiness, then it's logical the more you eat it, that you keep getting happier. Wouldn't take long to get happy, would it? A few pieces of cake were happy. But it's clearly not. What happens? You keep eating cake, it becomes disgusting. You keep getting the heat, it becomes too painful. You keep having the cold, you'll freeze to death. You keep having that husband too long. You know, when you're totally attached to that person. I mean, totally attached to that person. And you just cannot get enough of him. Day and night. After a while, with a friend of mine now, there's a story, you know, one of my friends was a monk for years. And he fell in love with somebody, so he disrobed. You can't have sex if you're a monk or a nun. You have to give it up, you know, you give up your robes, you give up your vows. So he gave up his vows. And he knew this person for a while. So, of course, in his mind, he didn't want to give up his vows, but this connection arose, this woman. He's building up all the energy, all the anticipation. You know what anticipation is like? It's such an intense experience. Anticipating even just the cake, forget about the gorgeous person. So imagine the anticipation. And then he said, Rabina, in the beginning, I was like a bull. I couldn't get enough. But he said, after now, 1 year, already I'm pleased to get away. You understand? This is samsara. This is the suffering of attachment. And then what happens is you fall in love, you meet this person, you jump in the bed, you can't wait, you're just in the bed again and in the bed again. But after a while, you kind of get bored. Excuse me, you know, I'm tired, I go to sleep. And then before you know it, and this is the point about attachment. The bubble has to burst with attachment. It is not sustainable. That deliciousness and that anticipation, the cake, you're so excited, you can't wait, and you go, the bubble has to burst. It's got to collapse down, and it's got two options where it goes, to aversion or to indifference. They're the three root delusions. Attachment has nowhere to go but to aversion or indifference. Are you seeing my point? Now, with cake, it always goes to aversion. It becomes disgusting if you eat too much, doesn't it? Look at that disgusting cake. It's the same cake. It's not even cold yet. It looked divine before, and you believed it. Now it looks disgusting, and you couldn't put it in your mouth even if you tried. Aren't you with me, people? Mm-hmm. Nothing changed in the cake, babies. It's our mind. So with people, what happens in our relationships, depending on the length of the karmic relationship with the people, the attachment could be there, which could also come along with good stuff, which means the relationship will stay. Maybe change its tune a bit, less sex, not worry about it, you know, but you're friends. That means you've got lots of good morality petrol in your petrol tank and the relationship lasts. How fortunate. That's not attachment that caused it to last. No, excuse me, it can be. Some people live their lives with attachment to each other, clinging like vampires, you know. Maybe not to sex so much, but to the be together, like, you know, like glued together. They become Siamese twins, I bet. I always hear, when I see Siamese twins, even especially when they're sharing their sex organs, I always think hearing say, may we never be separated. I'm serious. I'm really serious. You think about it. What else is Siamese twins? But unbelievable attachment. Will you share the same body? Can you imagine the suffering? Oh, my God. Oh, attachment's so disgusting. You've got to give it up, you know. It's like repulsive. How can you? It's terrifying. Oh, God. So attachment, you know, it's especially with people, fall in love, divine, he's like God incarnate, isn't he? From the tip of his head to his toenails, he's divine. I remember when I was in love, I remember his socks were divine, his smelly pillowcase, you couldn't get enough of it. I remember vividly. When it's really attachment. I always remember Angelina Jolie and Billy Bob Thornton. When you saw pictures of them, did you notice? You saw photos of them. They were like literally glued together. They had the most intense attachment imaginable. They used to drink each other's blood. They'd wear each other's blood. You can only imagine what else they did. That was just in public. They confessed to. Didn't last long. Look, she's then adopted a baby, Billy Bob, out the window, you know. I'm not being rude about it. It was just the most classic example of attachment. They could not get enough of each other. You could tell every photo they were clung together like this. Intense, you know. So the bubble, when the bubble bursts, it either turns into aversion, which is why you hate each other and you kill each other, or it turns into boredom. You wake up one morning, you think, well, who's that boring person next to me? Better leave, you know. There's only two ways for attachment to go. And that's the thing about these delusions. They all go, we go from one to the other, to the other, back to the other, back to the other, up and down like bloody yo-yos. That's the three main delusions: attachment, aversion, ignorance. You hear me? And we just go between these like drunken sailors, life after life after life. You know? Time to change, people. Time to give them up and get real bliss, real love, real compassion, real happiness, real stability, real clarity, real wisdom. That's all Buddha's saying. Have to hear it properly, you know. Are we communicating? So the job is to just to identify these liars in the mind. But the trouble is, it's a bit like, I think of, you know, if I look outside at all the green stuff, especially up in the tropics up here, all I see is, because it's more than just green, I can see that, you call it green stuff. I wouldn't have a clue the names of any of them. I can maybe recognise a gum tree, you know, I can recognise a rose. I wouldn't know what that yellow flower's called. I wouldn't know what this pink one's called. I don't know what they're called. I know that's a pineapple. You understand my point? I'm not good at botany, in other words. Okay, so if I look at all this overgrown green stuff out there, what good is that? I can't tell anything from anything. I can't tell one thing from another, can I? And someone who really knows botany well, they'll see little tiny miniatures. They'll, oh, there's this particular herb. Look at that. I'll go, what? You understand my point? So that's like we are with our minds now. There's this mass of overgrown junk in there, all entangled together, all the different voices, all the illusions, all the virtues. We vaguely notice some when they're really loud. Oh, there's a gum tree, you know. Oh, there's anger. But it's almost like too late. You practically kill somebody. It's a bit late to notice it. You're seeing my point. So that's why we've got to have this concentration technique. You've got to have the skill which you cultivate by developing this mindfulness and awareness, so that you can look at all the overgrown green stuff. But listen to this. If I don't know what to call everything, I can look at it all very mindfully, and I can even draw a bloody picture of it. But if I can't label what's there, what good is that mindfulness? Are you seeing what I'm saying? So it's not enough just to be mindful. This is obsession among so many people in the world, even who are Buddhists, who say mindfulness is all about what it is. I'm happy that you're mindful, that you can observe something, but if you can't label what you're seeing accurately, what good is that? Are you seeing my point? What good is that? So you've got to go to botany school and learn to know what a weed is, what a herb is, what this is. And there it's easy. You can learn distinctly each definition. You can do a drawing of a herb and a drawing of a weed and a drawing of a rose, and you can look at it very clearly and see all its characteristics. But then you see them all grown together, it's hard to tell the difference, isn't it? That's the same with our mind. So we can distinguish and articulate clearly what is anger, what are its characteristics. It exaggerates the bad things about somebody. It makes you feel angry. You convince the person is the cause of your suffering. You have aversion for them. We identify that. You think about attachment. It exaggerates the goodness. You believe it'll make you happy. The person looks divine to you. You go towards it. They've got characteristics. Jealousy's got this one. Pride has got this one. Each has got their own specific characteristics. They share common characteristics of being delusional and exaggerating. But they've got their own style, their own voice. We have to recognize those. We have to learn them first. So you learn each one. That's intellectual. You've got to start with that, like theory about botany. But then you apply it by looking into the chaos in here. Initially, not so easy. But slowly, if you have the understanding of what jealousy is precisely, not, you just don't wait till it's fully grown to notice you've got it. That's what we do now. So, but it's a bit late. It's like you're ready for the therapist by the time we notice our stuff. It's too late to notice it then. It's like you're driving on the freeway at 120 k's an hour and you're about to crash and you realise, oh God, I can't drive. Then you say, well, what'll I do? Well, not much. Damage control is about the best. You've got to go back to basics and start learning to drive. So for us, it's like that. We're driving in our life. We're about to crash and have a fight. What am I supposed to do? If you haven't looked at your mind, you've got no tools. If you haven't done the driving in the background, if you haven't sat down on your cushion every day and looked at your mind, you don't have anything to bring to an experience. It's too late to say, what'll I do when I'm about to have a fight? Can you see my point? You've got to do the background work. You've got to look in your mind. You've got to listen to Buddha's teachings. Look at what the mind is, how it functions. This. Listen. Look into yourself. Do your practices. Do your purification. Do your merit practices. Do your mantras. That's your preparations. That's your training. Then you bring all this to bear in your daily experiences, and then you get to be able to see what's in your mind well before the words come out the mouth. And you can turn the story around in your head before it gets out the mouth. That's the only way. That's what practice means. You see, so often we think meditation is you've got to sit down and you wait for a good feeling to come. You do compassion and you want tears to come out of your eyes. Oh, I had a good compassion meditation. That's childish. That's not the point. The meditation cushion is where you're doing the training on the back roads, so that you're prepared to get on the freeway and now you can drive well. The training on your cushion is where you're training your mind to do your concentration. You're training your mind to do your analysis and think about this and look at that and look at the problem and work things out and come to conclusions. And you get to see your mind ever more deeply in your meditation. Then you bring that same awareness into your daily life where you see your mind while you're driving. You see your mind while you're talking. So you're noticing and you're adjusting yourself. That's why you've got to do your training. Are you hearing me, people? And you build it up slowly, like practicing piano. Eventually it becomes experiential. You practice these intellectual, analytical type meditations, thinking about using logic to analyze why this and why that. We're going to do these later with the compassion meditations. They're really, really tasty. You think things through. Don't think that is not meditation. You've got a big misconception if you do. There are many kinds of meditation. But there's different techniques for familiarizing your mind. That's the meaning of the word meditation. You're familiarizing your mind like you do when you play the piano. You're familiarizing your mind with music until eventually it's spontaneous. Well, here we're familiarizing our mind with that which is true, which is wisdom, and that which is virtuous. So guess what? Then you become habitually virtuous, habitually wise. That's the job. Are you with me, Pete? Okay. So the delusions are distinctly different from the virtuous states. So love, for example, for a person, is the delight in their happiness, the wish they be happy. And we know we have this, but only for those we have attachment for, mostly. I mean, we do love the children, you know, our child who's left us, let's say, and hates us. We still want them to be happy. It's very painful. That is love. That's what love is. But usually for most of us, when the attachment stops, the love stops. When the hubby leaves you for a younger version, it's very hard to keep wanting him to be happy, isn't it? Some people are successful at it, which is fantastic. But mostly, love comes along with attachment. And that's why we mistake them for each other. That they're completely different states of mind. But they come to us. They're like the entangled weeds, but even more than that, they're like pureed soup, completely merged together. It's extremely hard to distinguish the different voices because we have them together. So in other words, the love we have now, it's not as if you have a bit of love, then you have a bit of attachment. The attachment is polluting the love. It's like the pollution in the water. You just can't distinguish it. So the love is there, but it's mixed with attachment. Can you hear my point? It's polluted by attachment. It's mixed with your needs and your neurosis and your hunger and your manipulation. It's very hard to see the difference, and that's why we've got to look into our lives. We can see it with some people who are really obviously, you know, we know that they're coming from a very manipulative place. That's all attachment is. But that's what our minds are doing at ever deeper levels. We've got to see it at ever deeper levels. And then learn to have the integrity to follow the love and not the attachment, which is very, very difficult. And certainly in relationships, where you build, because we've both got attachment, it's just the way the world is, you do love each other, but it's bucket loads of attachment. And this kind of way we, in relationships, what do we call in the West? Codependent, you know? It's a great term. You know, we're so scared of what the other person thinks, and we're so worried they'll reject us, And especially if you're like a peacemaker, you want to make everything lovely, lovey-dovey. Many of our actions of kindness are coming from the fear that he might get upset. He might think I did the wrong thing. He might think he mightn't like me anymore. So we're always trying to make it nice, looking like we're being loving, but it's just fear and panic and attachment. It's really giving endless mixed messages, you know. And because of this, you're afraid to say what you want. You're afraid to say how you feel. You might upset them. Many people who don't fight even, who are kind, you know, who do like this. Because you can't bear the thought of eruptions and dramas, you know. I remember in our life, never mind that, don't worry about that. So we've got to really watch our minds, you know. Really constantly watch. And then it's difficult in a relationship, because if you start to change and stop following all the ego tricks, it can be very nerve-wracking for the other person, because they're used to this kind of way we are codependent, you know. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. But if you don't respond so much with attachment anymore, but just try to have integrity, it can be quite misinterpreted. So it's not easy to change it in relationships. That's why this is such a personal, internal practice. It's your business. The person you live with mightn't be practicing. They don't even need to know you're practicing. It's your business. You don't need to talk about it. It's your internal practice. You working on your mind and your body and your speech, you know. And of course, when you start to change in this way, if you're used to living around with other people who do different things, you know, who gossip about people all the time, and ordinary people, your dear friends, you might end up giving up relationships. That's okay. Nothing wrong with that. There's no thing in Buddhism about it's bad to get divorced, you know. Bad to leave people. If the karma's finished, the karma's finished. Karma's like, you put, like I said, a certain amount of petrol in the tank, whether it's petrol to last your life a certain number of years, or whether it's petrol into a relationship, you know. So I think about, you know, about chewing in mocks. I've known them for years. I've been married, you know, but now, then I went off and became a nun for a while. Now she's not a nun, but she's living in a place like this, separate from her husband. But he's still hunky-dory. He's still fine. He supports. This shows there's some petrol in their tank of morality there. If it was only attachment, he would have hated her and given her up, you know, got really mad at her. But he hasn't. He's really supportive, isn't he? So that shows this, your relationship change. And that's where you see there's more things in a relationship than just attachment. There's a karmic connection. So obviously with you two, you'd say there's a good moral karmic connection. That it has, I mean, it doesn't mean it hasn't. It doesn't mean it won't finish. But it hasn't yet. Yes. Whereas most of it's mainly attachment and the love relationship. Then when you stop having sex with each other or something, he'll give you up and have someone else. Then goodbye, dear. The karma's over. The karma has finished, you know. It's not even as if it's only attachment, but it means also there wasn't much karma there. It just ran out. So it's not bad that it runs out. It doesn't necessarily mean you did anything wrong. We feel bad because we think it should have lasted. That's nonsense. If the karma's there, and that's why some people can learn to be friends with their ex-partners. They still can stay be friends, you know. That's because the morality is there. But it doesn't mean it's bad that it finishes. It just doesn't mean that at all. You learn from your experiences. You learn from your attachment and the pain. But if the karma's over, no matter how much you want him to be there, he won't be there anymore. And even if you don't want him to be there, he might still be there if the karma's still there. But you've got to learn to deal with it. Really. You know, it's like my friend who's the alcoholic husband. The karma's still there to be together, so she's accepted it and has learned to live her life around it, you know, instead of resisting it and getting upset and angry. Different people, different things. And so it's hard to know, because if you've got lots of attachment to one person and you can feel them moving away from you and you don't want them to, if the karma's finished, there's nothing you can do. You've got to let go. It's so hard. But you've got to know. And it's not easy, because we're always just following attachment. We've got to follow the wisdom. That's why we've got to have the wish, may I do what's most beneficial. And that's why, if it is beneficial to stay in that relationship or to stay in that job, and why would it be beneficial? Think about it. Either for others or to help you practice. If it really is good, like for your case, you know, 8 hours a day, if it really is right, you feel it's the right place to be because it's good practice for you. Not because you're scared to change jobs and you're fearful about security, but it's the right thing for you, then it's a fantastic experience. You really get, it's grist for the mill for your practice. And that's the way to make it. And that can be a relationship with a husband as well, like my friend with her alcoholic husband. Therefore, she's not unhappy. She's made it her practice. In other words, whatever it is we choose to do it. Most people stay in a relationship because they don't know how to change it, and then they blame the other person. They're never making it. So whatever you do, whether you choose to leave or you choose to stay, when you make it your choice, then you're free. Then you feel liberated. Then it's your life. But if you feel suppressed by it or you're victimized, then you just go crazy. And then you blame everybody else. You understand? But most people won't change relationships or jobs because they are so scared, so full of fear about doing what other people think they shouldn't do, by, you know, fear about security, fear about not being loved, fear about being alone. These are all the wrong reasons, and this is why people suffer so terribly. We've got to have integrity. We've got to have courage. You know, do the right thing. And know that if you keep practicing morality, you keep practicing generosity, no matter what happens, even though it's tough, it will be perfect. It will be fine. You've got to have the courage to make the tough choices, in other words, you know. But we're so craven for the nice things that we just make wrong choices all the time. And that's what following attachment does. So, you know, let's say many people say, oh, I'd like to be a monk, you know, or a nun or something. Now, what you've got to do, if the conditions haven't yet come together, if you haven't got to that crossroad yet, you just think, okay, if it's beneficial, may I become a monk. If it's beneficial, may I become a monk. Now, one of my friends, for example, a Buddhist, he always wanted to be a monk, and somehow he met this woman, they became married, they had babies, and it was the correct thing to do. He always wanted to be a monk, so he put that aside, and now there he is, 50-something, still a father, and he realises he absolutely wants to be a monk, but he knows it's not right in this life, so that aspiration will lead him to the next life. He's prepared to wait. So you've got to have a lot of humility and a lot of patience. You put the seed in, you make the prayer. If it's beneficial, may that happen. You've got to sow the seed. You don't just say, oh, I want an oak tree. You don't just say that. You've got to sow the seed. Then you'll get your oak tree. It takes time for it to grow. So you be patient, because the conditions all have to come together, you know, for it to be right. So have the aspiration. Nothing wrong with that. Don't be frustrated because you can't become a monk now or marry that person now. You just make the aspiration. If it's beneficial, may it happen when the time is right. Because karma is all about timing. It's like growing things. You can't force the flower up. You can't pull it up. You'll break it. You've got to put all the conditions together. You've got to sow all the conditions. Give it the right amount of water, soil, blah, blah, and then allow the conditions to come together and it will ripen when it's ready. You've got to have that kind of patience. It's logical patience, not neurotic, you know. Not kind of passivity. Patience isn't passivity. It's very dynamic. You put the right conditions together and then the results will come when the time is right, and you just have to wait. Like His Holiness, look at His patience. He has, you know, we think of patience, and we'll talk about this too when we do the six perfections, but we think of it as like a passive kind of aggression, really. Pushing your teeth, you know, waiting for this thing to happen. Patience isn't just sitting back passively. Look at His Holiness. 60 years now or something, isn't it, since the Chinese did their business. He hasn't stopped for one second doing something to help it change, but he's absolutely patient. He's doing it with a happy mind. But he's not sitting back waiting. He's proactive, but he's not frantically desperate for the change to come, you know. That's impatience. That's anger. So attachment, the root delusion, in this little model of the mind, the root delusion, the mother of them all, the cause of all suffering, such that when it's removed, you have then climbed out of samsara into nirvana, meaning you're out on the procedure of heading towards enlightenment. But from the first second of your first non-conceptual direct insight into emptiness, we're going to go into this. That is the first moment when you get out of samsara and you climb into nirvana. That's the way of saying it. The thing that distinguishes samsaric beings and Arya beings, the term, superior being, the distinctive marking, the distinctive, you know, point, the division, is this, the realization of emptiness. And that is meaning from the first moment of your first direct insight into reality, which is the first moment of finally pulling out the root of ignorance, the main delusion. That's the first moment of your beginning of your liberation. You can't fall back after that. So it's a crucial time. So the distinguishing delusion that makes a difference is this one called ignorance. This root delusion, ma-ripa, that has this primordial grasping at this sense of an inherent me. We'll talk about this later, or maybe now, who knows. Now we're talking about it. Why wait till later? It's 12 o'clock. I think we should stop at 12 again. We'll see how we go. So, ignorance is the root delusion. On the basis of that primordial misconception of self and everything else, we then have attachment. That's its main voice. This craving that this I we grasp at, will get what it wants. This craving, bottomless pit of attachment, then gives rise to anger when it doesn't get what it wants, which then gives rise to jealousy, and then they've got arrogance and all the other delusions that come as a result. They're like the branches. The root one is this ignorance. Therefore, the hardest to see. Attachment's hard enough to see. But as far as the Four Noble Truths are concerned, effectively, attachment is the main cause of our suffering in day-to-day life. And as Lama Zobrinche says, you know, it's when you look at the 12 links of dependent origination, this whole process we go through of life and death and life and death, attachment is the main one in daily life that drags us by our nose to make all the dumb choices. It's the basis of all our anger and all our dramas and our fights. And then at the time of death, two very intense levels of attachment called craving and then grasping. Intense ones at the time of death, which are levels of very deep attachment, ripen so powerfully. The craving is craving, grasping at this life, and then grasping, I think Moshe says, is grasping at the next. I'll look it up. It's in the book I'm editing at the moment. But this is intense level of attachment at the time of death. So if you haven't worked on your attachment throughout your life, and you haven't thought about impermanence, then of course at the time of death, you've got this frantic attachment, this frantic panic stations about having to leave this body, this life, those partners, those children, those possessions, that reputation, that profession, all the things that is the bubble of this life that we have created, that we do not want to leave, that we are terrified about. So attachment at the time of death is the worst thing of all, the worst suffering, you know, the worst. It completely destroys your mind. Then what it does is trigger, when this craving and grasping arise at the time of death, which they will do naturally, even if you've got virtue ripening, then they will just trigger the negative karma, because fear brings negative karma, and that will cause the karma to be a karma that will throw you into a lower realm rebirth because of that attachment. It's the worst suffering. Ignorance is the root, but this is the day-to-day taste, you know. So we've got to recognize it and got to see it, its workings throughout daily life. Slowly, slowly, slowly give it up. Slowly learn to give it up. Which means more pleasure, more happiness, more relaxed, more loving, more wise. Keep remembering that. Don't just think it's like panic, giving up something with nothing left. This is where impermanence comes in, you know. One of the major delusions Buddha talks about, which we don't list in the list of delusions as emotional delusions, but it's totally pervasive. And it's got a lot, it's kind of grasping it at being permanent. Grasping at being permanent. It's like attachment to things as being permanent. It's a very specific state of mind. And from the very beginning of Buddha's teachings, this is a massive teaching that he really runs with his own whole idea about impermanence. He talks about gross impermanence and subtle impermanence. So gross impermanence is the fact that the cup will break, the fact that I will die, the fact the flower will fade. That's pretty obvious, you know? We can see this with our eyes. That's not a hidden thing at all. But subtle impermanence is quite hidden. It's hard to see. We'll describe. Thanks. So subtle impermanence is the very fact that something is changing from millisecond to millisecond. And it's very similar to emptiness. And in fact, it's interesting. I remember talking to, in the Theravadan tradition, okay, there's a text, there's a thing you study in the monasteries, a text called Buddhist Tenets, which is the different presentation of the various schools of thought that have developed over the centuries in Buddhism. The broader category is the first two schools of thought are related to the Hinayana teachings, the Theravadan teachings, and the second two schools of thought are related to the Mahayana, and they've got their own subdivisions. And this philosophical presentation of the different approaches to many factors, including impermanence, but in particular in relation to emptiness, the different interpretations of different stages of emptiness in the various schools of thought, all according to the different levels of mind. So in the Theravadan schools of thought, their main meditation actually is on subtle impermanence, which can only be done in the subtle level of meditation. It's quite subtle. And they can be easily mistaking that for emptiness. I remember asking a Theravadan practitioner one time, one person, well, what about emptiness? Although that comes afterwards, that comes naturally. But this school, the Mahayanas would say that's a mistake. In fact, even one of the schools of thought mistakes subtle impermanence for gross selflessness, which is like emptiness. So it can, in the mind, it's, but it's a really good stepping stone to emptiness if we can get to the understanding of subtle impermanence. So subtle impermanence is the, it's like if you're watching your mind every moment, just watching your mind to try to get the idea of impermanence. As soon as you have this moment of mind, what happens is we cling onto it, this moment. I have a moment of mind. But then already, before you even let go of it, it's already become the next moment, hasn't it? So if you really look at even this, you can't even pin down a moment of mind. The second you have one moment of mind, already you go to the next moment. And look at the way we are with time. We break things down to, you know, millions of seconds now, isn't it? Even when they do the races in the Olympics, you win by a 50th of a second. It's like ridiculous. You keep breaking it down. You really can't pin it down to one tiny moment. It's already you got one moment, already it's the next moment. So it's a bit like there's nothing there. You're going from moment to moment. You understand what I'm saying? So subtle impermanence is the very fact that something is coming into being, it already turns into something else. You can't pin it down. It feels a bit like emptiness, and it's a good way to think about things in order to let go. Because if you can see the gross way we grasp onto something, whether it's that nice handbag or that nice relationship, that's a really obvious way we grasp at things as permanent. The attachment does this. It clings onto something. Okay, so you have masses of attachment to a certain person. Look at the way we write the stories in our head. We say, finally I have found happiness. You see what I'm saying? We feel I've got happiness now, and you get it and you lock it up. Now I've got it, permanent. That's a really obvious feeling of something being permanent. And a good example, I remember reading in Vanity Fair, you know, I read all the magazines. I like to read on my iPad now. I've got a whole pile of apps. I've got Vanity Fair, New Yorker, Newsweek, New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, The Age, the Sydney Herald, about four others. I really like to read newspapers. You learn about the world, let's face it, you know. Can't just live in a little bubble in my Buddhist head. Anyway, in one of the articles I read in Vanity Fair about Nicole Kidman, it was an interview with her and Tom Cruise when she was with Tom. Now she's with whoever he is. What's his name? Keith, that's right. And her two babies, she's got two daughters, and their names are Sunday and Faith. I read all about them. And they live in this amazing apartment in New York. I saw pictures of it, it's incredible. I heard about this building, where you go into a lift with your car, and the lift takes you to your apartment. In the car, you walk out your car, there's your front door. I think that's great, very sensible. So all these ugly underground garages, it's lovely. Anyway, there's Nicole. At the end of this article with her and Tom, at the end, she said, and we will be together until we're 80. That's how permanence, grasping at things, think. That's how we think. Because why do we think that? Not because it is permanent, but because we can't bear the thought of not having it. That's what it is. So it's based on attachment, if you think about it. You've got the happiness. And what's what you say? Finally, I've found happiness. And you write this entire novel about the next 80 years, what you're going to do with your life, you grow old together. We all talk this way, right? I'm not putting it down, not to be cynical. But this is because we want that. We believe it will be that. Because it's unbearable to think it won't be. That's the fear. That's what grasping at permanence is. So, of course, that's why we don't think about death. We know, if we do our market research, we know relationships break up. We know certain percentage turn into divorce. But when you first begin, and I'm not saying be cynical about it, oh, well, we'll get divorced, why bother getting married? But if we have this deeper understanding of impermanence, it doesn't mean you go, because right now if we think about impermanence all of a sudden, and we think, well, I could die today, for example, or Tom could leave me tomorrow, then we think, well, what's the point of bothering? We would think that, wouldn't we? What's the point? But if we have this idea of impermanence in a more integrated way, knowing that the very nature of life is that things change. You can't guarantee you will live together till you're 80. It doesn't mean you get cynical and then don't care, but you make the most of every day, given that it mightn't last till you're 80, although you'd like it to. There's a different way. You still want it to last till you're 80. There's nothing wrong, so you make it happen, but you won't be shocked if it doesn't. That's what understanding impermanence means. So you get the best of both worlds. I think a good example is if you go on a holiday, you go away for 2 weeks. You know it's impermanent. You know it won't last forever. Imagine if you forgot that it was only 2 weeks in the hotel. They'll drag you out screaming after 2 weeks because you forgot and you think it's now my permanent holiday, my permanent hotel. You know it's impermanent. And look what happens when you know it's impermanent. You make the most of it. You don't waste it. Do you understand my point? So you don't get cynical. You think, this is great, 2 weeks of a holiday. You go swimming every day and do this every day. You don't want to just go, oh, I'll swim tomorrow, you know. No, because you know it's going to run out very quickly. Because then when you realize impermanence, you actually make more life, you use your life in a better way. Because you're not just giving, oh, well, I'll do it tomorrow. Can't be bothered, you know, then you get stuck. Do you understand? It's so obvious, you know, but it's really hard to do. Because we don't like the idea of dying or Tom leaving us, you know.
When we experience grief, then,
yes,
is that because we've had
absolutely
attachment, absolutely, yeah, to our love?
Of course it is, but also it's a human thing because we've got close connections. Like His Holiness, you know, when he talked about his mother dying, he'd have tears, but they wouldn't last long. But if it was this sadness and the grief based on attachment, we'd keep having it and keep having it and get morbid and miserable and self-piteous and sink in it and get depressed. That's when it's based on attachment. But when it's just based on love and compassion, you'd think about the person, tears will come, you'll be happy they've got a future life, you'll do prayers for them, you'll acknowledge it and accept it. And it won't have ripped your heart out. Because you see, with attachment now, if, you know, I'm totally attached to Tom and I believe Tom's there till I'm 80, I'm giving him all my heart. And then he buggers off and leaves me, he rips my heart out as well. But if you're not attached, if you're not grasping at it so strongly, you love the person while you've got them, but you become your own person. You're whole in yourself. You're using the love from this person as nourishment, not just something to cling to. Because if I'm clinging to you and you leave me, I fall over. But if I'm taking your love and nourishing my own heart and becoming a wise, wonderful person, then my heart doesn't break when you leave. This is the big difference, you know. But if it continues, yes, it's to do with attachment. That's okay, we have to look at it. Don't force it away. So at the end of the article, after she said, we will be together till we're 80, she then said, and of course, if we won't be, I will be devastated. And indeed, she was devastated. She said she used to be in fetal position until her mother told her to get up and get on with it, you know. Of course, now she's forgotten about Tom because she's got Keith.
And the kids.
And I'm happy for her. I'm not being cynical. I'm so happy for her. She's gorgeous. I like her. So grasping it. So the major one about impermanence, of course, is very in the Lam Rim. The way this Lam Rim business is, you know, Buddhism's been in Tibet since about the 8th century, I think. Guru Rinpoche, Padmasambhava, this amazing Indian great saint and yogi and scholar, went to Tibet, and he was the first one to bring it there, 700s or something it was. So then from there it started to develop, you know. And so all the first years it was Padmasambhava and all his students, which has since become known as the old tradition, which is Nyingmapa. That's what it means, the old tradition. It was the beginning. And then from there, in about the 10th century, I think, or 11th, I can't remember now, new sort of traditions began, like they call them Sakya and Kagyu. So Milarepa, these famous Tibetans, Milarepa, Marpa, all these different people, they're sort of gradually like different traditions, a bit like sort of Catholicism, you know, Anglican, blah, 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 but not quite as divided, I don't think. They can be sometimes. Just variations, sort of going off in certain traditions, different practices and things, generally speaking the same, you know. So then in the 14th century, sorry, about the 11th century, this Indian, great Indian saint and scholar called Atisha was invited by the king to come and teach in Tibet, and he spent his last 17 or something years there, you know. And he saw a bit, maybe from his perspective, he thought they'd kind of lost the plot a bit. Dharma was amazing and rich and incredible tantric practitioners here and amazing yogis over there. But he sort of felt that there was a bit of a disconnect between seeing it in the big picture. So what he did was he got all of Buddha's teachings and he presented them in this really orderly way, putting it into this course, basically, which is they call the graded path. So he put all the teachings, took the essence of each of the major points of Buddha's teachings and practices and metaphysics and logic and philosophy and psychology, and presented them in a very simple way, in an orderly way, orderly, insofar as according to your capacity to study them and internalize them, which is how any course is, isn't it? Perfectly reasonable. Just they use this quaint phrase called Lam Rim and this quaint phrase called lower scope, middle scope, great scope. I like to call junior school, high school, university, and then Tantra, postgraduate. So it's done in an orderly way, you know? So that's the benefit of this particular text that he wrote called Lamp for the Path, the light that guides you on your road, you know? And really, much of all the traditions, to varying degrees, the four main traditions in Tibet, Nyingma, Sakya, Kagyu, Gelug, and actually there's many subdivisions of those as well, various schools of thought that do certain practices, you know. according to different types of minds, they all really refer to Atisha, back to this. But Tsongkhapa in the 14th century, who's the Gelug, the head of the Gelugpas, which is the main tradition of my lamas, not all, I mean, Tsongkhapa Kensa Rinpoche is one of my lamas too, but my main tradition, the teachings I'm giving here, coming from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, from Lama Zopa, Lama Yeshe, are in the Gelug tradition from Tsongkhapa. He really is the one who used the term Lam Rim. In the Sakyas, they call it Lam Dre. In the, you know, there's different ways of presenting. All the Tibetans are very good at this, in structuring very nicely, in a very coherent, cohesive way, the teaching, so it's easy to practice, so you know where you're at on the path, you know. So in this Lam Rim, the very first thing Atisha wants us to do, like junior school grade one, he gets us to think about impermanence. Buddha's major teachings on impermanence, but he doesn't even talk about subtle impermanence. He gets us right between the eyeballs and he wants us to think about gross impermanence. And not only that, he gets us to think about death and impermanence, the impermanence of death. And why death? Well, he's got an agenda here. First of all, it's the first level of teachings to think about impermanence. But his agenda is, because we want to think, he wants us to think about death, he wants us to get a wake-up call. Because if you realize about the impermanence of death, it's so dramatic that it gives you the wake-up call to not waste your life. But as a result, you also learn about impermanence. But he gets us to, it's a wake-up call he wants us to get. That's his real agenda here. Do you understand my point? Not just, it's very nice to think about impermanence. You can sit there and meditate on impermanence for a long time. It's very spacey and nice, but you're not getting some kind of sense of urgency. And, he wants us to get a sense of a wake-up call not to waste this precious life. So what's his point? The first point to think about, the three main points, the first one is that death is definite. Now we go, yeah, all right, mate, we know that. Give me something more intelligent to talk about. But the fact is we know it intellectually. But as we can all see, because we have this massive attachment and we become attached to things and people and events, and because they're nice, we don't want them to end. Therefore, what we do is we mistakenly project onto them the characteristic of being permanent. So clear. So what we have to think about logically, this is the type of these types of meditations we do. In Tibetan, they call them analytical meditations, which sounds a bit weird to us. Because we think meditation is opposite to analytical. But it's a very grand term for the verb to think. That's all it means, to think, to think it through. Don't underestimate this, you know. If you know, even now sitting here, each of us, I'm talking, but I'm listening as much as anybody. I'm thinking it all through. We all know ourselves. You've got to first listen to something. Then you go home and you think it through. Whether it's knitting, cooking, or Buddhism. The same procedure, isn't it? You don't think it's insulting to have to go and think about cooking in order to become a good cook. You don't think, oh, I don't want to think about it. It's too, you know, thinking's inferior. Don't be ridiculous. You've never learned to cook if you don't think about it. But then eventually thinking it through makes you make the cake and then eventually get the experience. Same here. Same here. Same here. So we think about the fact that death is definite, which means that everything that comes into being will necessarily die. Now, we will say, yes, intellectually, I know that. In fact, we'd be embarrassed to admit anything opposite. We know it's true. But all Buddha's saying is we know it intellectually, but we act as if it's not true. So to think about this, what does that mean? You can do it in your meditation, but you can do it in daily life. You see sentient beings. You see ants die. You see creatures die. You read about death all the time. So what we would normally do is just then think about it as gossip. As ants will die, who cares? People we love die, we get sad and brokenhearted. Enemies die, we almost cheer. Strangers die, we couldn't care less. So that what's the real way here to make it grist for the mill, to make it teachings for you? The first one is God. That's going to be me.